Awesome. Hello all and welcome. This is a special topic call with the NIST folks on a wonderful draft, which is SP 800-63-4, which has to do with digital identity guidelines, something which many of us here in this community work on just a little bit. So we really appreciate them coming in today to kind of intro the work, answer questions, help provide clarity. Appreciate the call out in the draft around making sure that hopefully there are some upcoming things like verifiable credentials, for instance, can be covered by some of this stuff. Just a quick reminder that this meeting, as with all CCG and W3C meetings, is covered by the Code of Ethics and Professional Conduct. I don't think we'll have any issues there, but just have to put that reminder out. And this is a, you know, public meeting. We're not discussing work items here, but if we are, if someone wants to contribute into a CCG work item of any kind, you do need to join. If there's anyone like that that needs that information, don't hesitate to ask in the chat or email directly or email the list, and we can get you joining information. With that, just being sensitive to time, I am going to invite the NIST folks to kick it off and maybe give a good 10 minute or so overview, particularly of the, not just the draft itself, but maybe some thoughts around how they think there's overlap with this community. And then I've got a couple of questions just that the chairs and I, the other co-chairs and myself, worked out ahead of time just in review of the docs, and then we'll just monitor the queue the normal fashion. So if you're unfamiliar with this group or new to this group, if you hit the raise hand button, it will add you to the queue. Otherwise, you can just in the chat type the letter Q followed by plus, and it will add you to the queue. And I will ack you and call on you when it is your time. So with that, NIST, take it away.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for inviting us today and for giving us an opportunity to have a conversation with you. I'm going to make a very, bold assumption that most of you all are familiar with who NIST is and what our role is within the identity space. Kind of sort of within the title of our organization, but primarily building standards and guidance. 863 revision 4 is our most current draft of our digital identity guidelines. Obviously there's been several revisions in the past. Revision 3 being probably one of the more notable changes in the kind of scope and structure of how the digital identity guidelines were functioning. It expanded what had previously been in Revision 2, kind of a more monolithic document into one that addressed different aspects of identity in different ways. So it split what was kind of a gigantic document into 4 documents, all of which are also kind of gigantic in their own right at this point in time. But really, it provides a set of guidance and requirements that address your base identity model and risk management. You're in our base volume. 863A covers the identity proofing enrollment process. So how do you kind of validate and verify identity information in order to establish an account and grant an individual credential for authentication? The authentication volume, which is B, which covers multi-factor authentication, use of different kinds of credentials, and establishes our authentication assurance levels. And then 863C, which covers our federation requirements and federation assurance levels across the board. So we are attempting with the guidance to cover the full life cycle of an identity up until the point where you start having authorization conversations, which falls a little bit outside the scope. Some of the main things we were looking to do in this particular vision, so we had gone through and done a pretty decent amount of engagement and discussions and released a call for comments in 2020 prior to the pandemic. And so we had started the process of updating this and evolving this to the next step well before the pandemic started. However, as with many of these other, the other things that the digital world experienced, when the pandemic hit, you know, there's obviously a lot of attention that got turned to, online benefits, online programs, and rapid transition to, you know, from physical and from more legacy-based programs to more digital and online programs, and with that, the protection of those through identity and digital identity solutions. So we kind of continued and accelerated the feedback process to try and gain more feedback from organizations that had shifted into this realm, and make sure that we really captured a lot of the lessons learned there. So when it came down to it, we were really focused on making updates, one, to start dealing with issues of equity. With 63.3, we did a lot to kind of elevate privacy and usability into the conversation that had previously been kind of the realm of just security. With this revision, we're attempting to bring, I think, to a higher level concerns around equity and equitable access to services, primarily as a result of observations during the pandemic, and the reality that a lot of these critical services need to get to the right people at the right time. And identity solutions and technologies need to be able to support that. We want to make sure that agencies and organizations are evaluating not just the security benefits of a solution, but also how implementation of that technology and those solutions may ultimately impact the ability for an individual to gain access, and whether they're inadvertently creating scenarios where entire communities or groups or types of individuals aren't able to access benefits as well as others. So really dealing with that equity piece, bringing new options to the table, and this is actually one of the key reasons we're here having conversations today, is we're really trying to explore how to bring additional identity evidence, identity credentials to the table to help individuals better achieve positive outcomes when it comes to interacting with online services. And really, again, this kind of goes hand in hand with equity, but also with convenience and security, because what we'd like to be able to do is provide, you know, the larger community with the ability to make use of better and different and evolving technologies and options. So looking at things such as digital evidence, whether through something like mobile driving license or something like a verifiable credential that may be held, maintained, and protected by the individual, but then asserted and able to be trusted by something like a government agency or organization. So again, that's part of the reason we're here to have these conversations with you all today. We're also looking to make sure that we're addressing some of the latest threats that have emerged in the wake of the pandemic. Obviously, phishing resistance is something that's key to 863B at this point in our authentication scheme, and making sure that we're providing options that allow organizations and end users to avoid the very common pitfalls that surround phishing as an authentication method, or phishing authentication methods that are vulnerable to phishing. And then also looking at how the identity proofing aspect of things can be compromised through things like social engineering, as well as the vast automated enrollment attacks that we saw at the very beginning of the pandemic. So making sure that we had controls built in to address some of the things that we saw very commonly as the pandemic rolled out. Wanted to make sure we address lessons learned and really take into account the fact that the guidance at this point are 5 years old. Identity models, identity technology, identity solutions are evolving. But also we're learning about the things that, where the words didn't necessarily equal the outcomes we were intending when it got transitioned from standard to code and to implementation. So making sure we got good feedback from the community there. Overall, I think there's been a substantial number of changes to the guidance in every one of the volumes. But just at a high level, some of the major changes within revision for the base volume, we've kind of updated and moved a little bit away from some of the more strict interpretations of how to do risk management around identity that were in the previous version, and focused a little bit more on a process-oriented approach that allows for a bit more flexibility and tailoring from organizations and agencies in the selection of their assurance levels and technologies. We have focused a bit more on things like digital evidence. And again, this is one of the main reasons we're here today, is to understand, have we gone far enough and what do we still need to do within our guidance to support things like verifiable credentials that meet with trust expectations for the government community, as well as things like mobile driving license and how those can be part of an overall trust scheme for identity proofing and potentially for authentication as well. We've taken an updated 863C pretty substantially, so evolving away from some of the traditional Federation Assurance components to be a bit more clear and concise about what we're expecting at each Federation Assurance level and making sure that they are achievable. I think there was a lot of concern over some of the language and requirements that exist around FAL2 in particular that made it hard to understand, what were the specific threats we're attempting to mitigate and how to really implement and address the controls appropriately. So, that's kind of the nutshell, probably not quite a 10 minute here, but happy to dive into specific.
No, I think that was an excellent intro, and I really appreciate it. And I'm actually going to start because there's a section in the draft, like the initial public draft, where I think it's on page 8, right? And I'm going to paste the text in the chat just so folks can reference it if they need to. But it says, our emerging authentication models and techniques, such as FIDO passkey, verifiable credentials, and mobile driver's licenses, sufficiently addressed, accommodated as appropriate by the guidelines. And then what are the potential associated security, privacy, and usability benefits and risks? Awesome statement, right? One thing, though, that I thought was interesting is just kind of in doing some text mining, since I tend to work in the NLP side of the world a lot and have a lot of background there, is there's not a single mention of VCs really in 863, right, or potential use, at least in the initial public draft. And the other gap that I thought was really interesting was the lack of a mention of decentralized identifiers. And so maybe 63, you know, -4 could be an option. Like, I'm just going to put two links into the, from the glossary, the NIST glossary into the chat here. And Sandy, there is no slide deck. This is just pure discussion, and Q&A. You know, VC still pulls back to validating cash in the glossary. Does link to decentralized identifier, does show that there are some sources in the two blockchain assessments, and there's no definition given. And there's a TR out for that, and there's been a TR that's now on 1.1 working its way towards 2 for verifiable credentials. And so maybe this could be an option, an opportunity just to kind of improve what do we mean when we say these terms, right? Let's actually point to the specs from the glossary and stuff like that as people are, you know, kicking into stuff. So that was just like an initial thing. But I, philosophically, like, really want to appreciate the reach out. And too, I think the spirit of that statement about, like, are we covering these things, it was great. The fact that it's talking, though, about digital identity and the fact that then there's no call out to decentralized identifiers, right, or DIDs in any way, shape, or form seemed a little odd to me, because that's the identity portion. Though VCs will oftentimes be linked into that, that's more the identity portion. And so it just struck me as odd. Do you have any commentary on that or thoughts and feedback? Because obviously there's DIDs that work with a federated model. There's DIDs that work with, like, just pure web linkage, et cetera, right, as well as kind of full-on individual identifiers as well.
Yeah, I think what I would argue is that we discuss the use of identifiers. I don't think that we make a distinction between a centralized versus a decentralized versus any different form or function of identifiers. We do mention verifiable credentials in 863A. I don't know that we go so far as to define it per se, but I think that's something that's very reasonable given that the words show up in the document. But from an identifier perspective, I don't think we intended to make any kind of a distinction between the different types of identifiers that may or may not be used within a model.
Manu, I'm going to hit you first. Let's just dive right in.
Hi, Ryan. Thank you, for, you know, taking the time to come here and present the work. I know many of us have read, 863 and a variety of other, you know, NIST documents. I'm one of the editors of the verifiable credentials, standard, as well as the decentralized identifier one. And there's a desire in that working group. So I'm talking about the World Wide Web Consortium working group that works on verifiable credentials. There's a desire to use portions of 863 in fields like evidence. So when we create a verifiable credential, we have these fields that we could use a number of 863 kind of terms in, like evidence. You know, what documentation did you provide to generate this credential? That's one way of looking at it. More recently, we have had discussions around basically like identifier proofing or identity proofing. You know, if someone is presenting this verifiable credential to you, you know, as a verifier, how can you bind this digital credential to the individual if you don't have a cryptographic identifier, for example? So, there's this you know, real deep desire to reuse 863. And in the same way that, you know, the document asks the question, are we talking about verifiable credentials appropriately here in 863? I think the verifiable credentials group has the same ask. Are we talking about 863 in a way that you intended it to be used, right? One of the concerns is that the language in the NIST publication is can be interpreted fairly broadly. And so we think it would be really useful if you or a number of people that are working on this document can help us with some concrete examples of how we leverage 863 in the verifiable credentials specification. So I think the concrete ask here is, would it be possible to come and present some of the stuff to the verifiable credentials group so that we can better integrate it with the work that's happening in that group?
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love to come present. I think one of the things we want to at least be able to do, hopefully in some kind of concrete way, is be able to illustrate where all these different emerging standards and profiles and specifications and guidance actually fit together to create a nice consistent picture of how to use identity versus continuing to have a bit of a fractured view of the world when it comes to these things. So yeah, we'd be more than happy to join and present on 63 as well as, you know, how we see it potentially fitting into, you know, the VC kind of universe as well. Andy, I think you can. Yeah. And by the way, I'm not the only one here from NIST. I just happen to be the one who come
just
off
just volunteer to be on the spot at the moment.
Yeah, off of this circle. Andy, I saw you come off mute there, so I'm going to throw you under the bus here and see if you had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, and I think that question and comment, I mean, I think it brought up a lot of very good points. I mean, one piece of context is, you know, we try to write 863 to cover a broad range of technologies. We're trying to have it be sort of implementation agnostic. So the idea that it could be interpreted quite broadly is often a feature. Although I know that then, you know, creates a, you know, sometimes a lack of clarity on how things fit in. But I think you raised some good points about like where things like verifiable credentials can fit in. And as we were working on 863, I think we had a lot of similar discussions about the kind of different models and use cases. And I think that's ultimately why you don't see VCs specifically used throughout the documents, because we sort of saw it potentially fitting in multiple places. For instance, I think you made a very good point about, you know, verifiable credentials could be used as digital evidence that's presented during a proofing process so that an applicant could, you know, provide, you know, cryptographically secured proof that they have certain attributes. A verifiable credential could, you know, through a verifiable presentation, could also be effectively used as an authenticator, as a cryptographic authenticator in 863, depending on what type of protocol it's used with. And I think third, you know, in some cases, the presentation of a verifiable credential looks an awful lot like Federation and presenting an assertion. And so we thought that, you know, this was, you know, depending on both the use case and the specific implementation, things like verifiable credentials could fit in a number of places within 863. And I don't know how well that, you know, if that matches kind of your thinking of potentially how it could fit in.
Yeah, Mina, do you have a clarification there, or do we want to let Dan go?
I do. That's great. I think the biggest challenge that we've had in attempting to use 863 in the group is, you know, some of us will say, oh, well, you know, we believe that you can use it in this way. And we provide kind of like a concrete mechanism, like an identity proofing event or, you know, evidence or something like that. And usually the counter argument is like, that's not how 863 is supposed to be used, right? And so it becomes challenging to cite the document and utilize it because there's disagreement on what some of the language may or may not mean. In, you know, I hate to say we need someone to referee the conversation, but having input into, you know, what was expected, you know, to come out of the language that's in 863 would help us make some of the statements there that are general, which I agree with you, it's supposed to be, you know, that's a feature. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to make it, really concrete, in the working group or work around it. Because as you know, many of us are working with, nation states around the world, on digital identity, digital permanent resident card, digital driver's licenses, things of that nature, where we're trying to use the guidance in 863 and make it concrete, but we're challenged in that we don't have some of the people that wrote it in the room to sanity check what we're doing. So I think the general ask here is that, you know, would it be possible to pull each of you in from time to time to let us know whether or not we're on the right track or not when we're doing these concrete implementations?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd be happy to advise on the intent of the guidance. I think just to make sure that we're clear on where that line would exist is we can't really be running around saying that we have certified or validated or approved anything. But I think where there's questions of interpretation, where there's questions of what exactly did you mean here? Number one, I think we'd be happy to participate and help make sure that you all understand what we were trying to do so that you can harmonize and leverage it within your own specifications and standards. But also it'd be immensely valuable for us to understand where you're seeing challenges in the interpretation as well, too. I mean, we're in a comment period, we're in a draft period here. So that, you know, if there are things that are not as clear as we think they are, and the applicability and viability of the guidance is not as concise as it could be, I think that'd be also extremely helpful for us to understand both from like a conversational perspective, as well as if you're able to provide us, you know, some written kind of documentation where you see some of those issues. It would be extremely valuable for us to know where other parts of the community aren't necessarily clear on what we're trying to get to.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that, and I know we had some pre-conversation around this just in prepping to make sure we got everything out on the table, at least the highest priority items, is that there's a big gap in terminology across the identity space today. And so when we look at 863-4, right, it's still kind of carrying over a lot of the old school terminology from the enterprise and government side that might have moved on in the last 5 years in some ways, right? There are different models and different language in use. So I think this is an area that, you know, it's extremely timely. And in this comment period, it's a great way to help clarify and refine that stuff. Dan, I see you on the queue here.
There it goes. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thank you for this opportunity. Let's see. Oh, okay. I don't know if we should use cameras as well, but happy to. And I did put it in the chat, but it when we talk about verifiable credentials and things like that, we typically, yes, it can be used kind of standalone, but we typically think of it in a decentralized identity sort of fashion. But unless I didn't read the suite correctly after going through it a few times, everything in it is centralized to the point where, quote, throughout the digital identity lifecycle, CSPs shall maintain a record of all authenticators that are or have been associated with each subscriber account. To me, there's no room for decentralization at all. I do appreciate the inclusion of switching topics somewhat of more biometric things in there, but only one-to-one biometric comparison is mentioned. Nothing about one-to-many. And we use the term identity proofing, which you say includes, and the first bullet is identity resolution, determining that the claimed identity corresponds to a single unique individual within the context of the population. Well, the best way to do that is through biometrics. That's not even mentioned. Identity proofing seems to be, in my read of this suite, identity verification. There's no mention that I've read of how do we resolve an identity to a single unique identity within the context of the population. Everything that I read relies on somebody else doing that, where you talk about using a passport or a driver's license or a social security number. Anyhow, I've documented dozens of questions and things, but those are the two that kind of bubble up to the surface.
So I think that's – so I'm going to attempt to parse through this, and Andy, I'll let you jump in as well too. I think Connie and David are on as well, so if you all have feedback. So number one of the things we're attempting to do with this documentation is, yes, we allow for biometrics, but also we want to account for the fact that there's a lot of folks that are very uncomfortable with biometrics, very uncomfortable with technologies like face recognition, and also acknowledging that there's not really standard common – you know, repositories that could be gone to in many cases to be able to use a biometric purely for resolution when you have a large population to deal with, like the entire U.S. government's population to deal with. So what we look at the starting point is primarily resolution through the use of attributes and unique attributes that can resolve not necessarily to unique individual across the entire planet, but potentially even within just a subset of records or things to deal with. So that's kind of what we're talking about with resolution. There's certainly the possibility to use biometrics for that. However, given the kind of scale and scope of what federal agencies do need to deal with, it's not necessarily the easiest thing to turn to right away, particularly when we're talking about the challenges around biometric performance for one-to-many type use cases. So again, we're looking to try and allow for a broad range and spectrum of potential technologies to be applied. And that includes biometrics where appropriate and with the right controls, but also making use of things like data validation and data matching where we can for the moment. On the centralized versus decentralized perspective, I think it's a very fair comment that the current context and discussion that exists around the content is that it is very kind of heavy in the traditional CSP centralization focus. I think there's ways that you could look at it to imply that, you know, if you look more at functionality rather than purely the kind of traditional view of a CSP, you can make an argument that a CSP could be something that doesn't necessarily have to be run by an entity and organization, but it certainly is heavily implied. So we'd be very interested in feedback directly on how to make sure that our model is reflective of additional deployment modes beyond kind of the traditional agency runs a CSP operates on behalf of an agency or an organization, as well as, you know, how something like individually owned credentials, again, assuming that there are ways to place rules and expectations around those verifiable credentials or whatever that individual is using to represent themselves. So we'd be interested in direct feedback on how to potentially fit that into the model. Andy, Connie, David, any additional thoughts that you'd like to provide? Does anybody have advice on how to get these pop-ups from the chat thing to stop flying around? Dan, hopefully that was helpful. I'm not sure if anyone else from the team does want to weigh in there.
Yeah, I think definitely helpful. Yeah. You know, the CSP, thinking of the CSP in non-traditional ways, that was not clear to me from the text. So that's like an immediate feedback area, right? That area, and maybe Andy, I saw you come off mic, might have some thoughts on that. But.
Yeah. And I do think that it's a fair reading to look at what we have today and say it certainly expects the CSP, particularly in a proofing process, to be going through a full resolution process. It really only kind of explicitly envisions a case of that the user is using a single CSP. But I think Ryan's right too, that I think there's room in the model for, any entity that might be issuing, say, a verifiable credential could be considered a sort of CSP. And, you know, likely we may have to make some, adjustments to the model to be able to accommodate that. And I guess I'd be really, you know, interested as you're reading through the documents where you think there is a need for those kinds of adjustments.
Yeah, and I was going to say just a quick note. I know it was typed in the chat, but if you actually click the little chat icon on the toolbar and open the chat dialogue, it'll open up on the left-hand side, and then pop-ups will go away because they can be aggravating with the transcriber. So, and yes, Connie, we can hear you now. So, sorry.
Oh, okay. Yep. Okay. I was just talking to myself there for a couple of seconds. It's fine. I like my own company. But I think both Ryan and Andy have covered it. I mean, one of the challenges of the 800 series special publications from NIST, is that they're for feds based on the policy requirements in the federal space, required. So, part of the issue that we look to is, one, we want to be flexible and inclusive, but we also recognize that despite our guidelines being voluntary in other contexts, they are required. So what does the market look like? Can feds implement what we're guiding them towards? So, you know, we try to be aspirational and forward-looking, but we also know that when you are an entitlement program whose remit is the entire United States public potentially, that's just a very, very different context than the flexibility that a smaller entity might be able to have in making decisions. So I just add that context because I think it's important and it can get lost in these conversations that tend toward the art of the possible and the theoretical. But just know that that's, you know, that's a reality that we live in every day. And I think we can only update the guidance with your help. So I'll just echo what Ryan and Andy have already said, which is if you have ideas about how to make the text, more reflective of the type of work that you're trying to do, that is one of our goals. So I just thank you for looking at it and considering some specific inline updates for us. Thanks.
Awesome. Yeah. And there's two folks on the queue. I did want to call out a comment, and or question from the queue from Christina, who I know is one of the chairs over at the VC working group. One of the things, and this I think also jumped out at me and some others I talked to in advance of this meeting, is that there's not a clear mapping to the notion of like issuer, holder, verifier type roles, in this. And when we are thinking about these large organizational things, and I'm sure some folks may or may not jump in, but like there are some really big rollouts going, right? And tests going, including with, you know, Gov. So, if we can find a way that this text allows us to discuss those roles and how they map, that's a very helpful starting place to then talk about how VCs integrate, right? And that's something that's just not really present. And in that three-party model, I think there are ways you could very broadly interpret it that way, but you have to go really broad, which then gets highly, highly problematic, right? When stepping through and trying to say, well, yeah, but I'm using this, but that's not really what the text says, et cetera, right? Christina just noted, maybe a third table is needed in addition to table one and two and, you know, or an independent, right, that says, look, here's part D or E, right, that says this is how, you know, VCs or the VC model maps over, right, in the first tier for evidence, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's really valuable feedback. And I actually, I don't remember where I saw it, excuse me, but I have seen someone who did this mapping. It was a couple years ago. I need to remember where it was and go annoy whoever it was that did it. But I think that's really valuable and helpful. And I think from our perspective, it will also probably help us as well, too, as we start to think about where we might have some inadvertent gaps or challenges to how this can be interpreted. I mean, I was having a call with some folks on the MDL side not too long ago, and we were kind of joking about how we needed to just create like a glossary that translates yeah. 63 to MDL to verifiable credentials, so we all know what language we're speaking, and make sure we're speaking the same and other international standards like I think some of the stuff around 29115 and 29003 yep. coming out of ISO that aren't quite the same as what we say. I mean, there, we almost need like kind of a translator for all the various different forms and functions of identity conversations going on. But I think from a mapping perspective, that's probably a good place for us to at least start as an exercise and hopefully to kind of support what you've got as well too. Yeah, exactly. But I think that's helpful for us as well to try and look at those things and provide some understanding from how the models fit or don't fit and how we might need to make some adjustments of where they would need to be. So I think that must be a very helpful recommendation.
Yeah, Stefan, I see you on the queue there.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for the opportunity to have this call. I think there is perhaps an unintended consequences out of the fact that basically only have two models. One is that of a silo and the other one is that of federated identity. And the unintended consequence is that of that IDPs will know where people log in. And I'm here from the US healthcare perspective. And while it might not be a problem that IDPs know where people are logging in as far as which agency, they're logging with, in the healthcare, of course, as polarized as the opinions are, it does matter, right? Like, you know, which specialty clinic you see and you have interactions with is actually almost, you know, health information, right? And so what I maybe want to just see if I can get some initial kind of, you know, responses from you is on the fact that maybe it needs a third model that's maybe not calling decentralized identifier, but decentralized identity as opposed to federated identity. And the important part there is almost like in the model, instead of grouping the verifier to the CSP, you know, what if we group the verifier to the RP and let the CSP be its standalone thing, that of being an issuer of a verifiable credential, right? So my point is, at the moment where the identifier becomes the authenticator, a cryptographic authenticator, the model just significantly shifts. And I think we have a very important aspect, as I mentioned before, around privacy, that really needs to be mapped into the model, even though it may not apply for the agencies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's reasonable feedback. I would say that some of this will help as we start to go through and evaluate. I would also note that, for example, the way you can deploy and do the functions of a CSP as a federal agency or as an individual organization doesn't necessarily mandate that you would always track beyond your agency. But I think it's a very fair point that the CSPs would most likely know where individuals are going. So I think it's reasonable to make that suggestion. I also think from just kind of a general perspective, we don't really break apart the CSP capabilities within the model as it's depicted. So things like providing attributes and stuff like that or verifiable credentials isn't easily recognizable. And I think it's, again, fair criticism and very open to recommendations on how to adjust for that. And I think Andy just came off mute as well, too.
Yeah. And I mean, truth be told, we've been talking about something kind of similar to this quite a bit, actually, recently around, you know, the model of federation that we cover in 863C is, you know, it's limited to the scope of, you know, federated identity in the sense of, you know, passing assertions from an IDP. It doesn't cover perhaps the, you know, broader notion of, you know, how you might trust a, you know, like interorganizational trust, that would also come up in contexts like PKI. So I think this idea, you know, whether you want to say that it's, you know, breaking apart the functions of the CSP, as Ryan was saying, or, you know, attaching, identity attributes to authenticators. Like there is that model that I do understand doesn't really quite fit into a single place in the current structure of 863. And I, you know, speaking for myself, I guess I'm not really sure where, you know, if we wanted to cover that explicitly, where it would best fit, you know, is to what extent is this, you know, is this authentication? Is this some broader notion of federation? Or is it, as you, I think we're perhaps suggesting, is it kind of a third, you know, a third model that could be addressed separately?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, again, the subtlety is that the identifier becomes the authenticator, right? So the authentication flows. This gives us a chance to do the authentication flows without having the need for the IDP, right? So it can be come back to be directly done with sort of like still having the benefit of the verified attributes be communicated through VCs, right? We're thinking about sort of submitting, you know, how that model would look like and how these flows would look like, but maybe this community here might actually, you know, be willing as well to kind of maybe think about it more as a third model rather than just, you know, individual components like verifiable credentials and decentralized identifiers, right? It's just, again, I think it's that authentication flow that's the biggest privacy concern.
Yeah, that was definitely awesome. And we could circle back after we process the queue around some of the implied, like, you know, privacy implications and things like that, that VCs, I think, explicitly might have some answers for that the traditional model doesn't. Dan, I see you on the queue.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. And that, yeah, that's exactly what was the point I was trying to make at the beginning. If, you know, where the CSPs maintain the authenticators, and they have to be, the relying parties always have to go back to the CSP. Well, then that is definitely not privacy enhancing. But I raised my hand again because, you know, when Connie was talking about, you know, this guidance being, you know, for federal, for entities and things like that, you know, another key point here, and you talked about talking to, drivers, you know, motor vehicle authorities. I hope too that you talk with, Department of State. And this goes back to, you know, the point you made, we don't have foundational identity in the U.S. Broadly. We don't have a national ID. But where you say that the CSP validates the authenticity, accuracy, and currency of presented evidence, well, you know, Department of State, we still, to this day and a few other countries, allow folks to take our own photographs, manipulate them, maybe morph them, and it's been proven that some people have, and send those into Department of State where they cryptographically sign them. But how are they authentic? How are folks looking at the authenticity of a passport photo? Yes, they could see that Department of State cryptographically signed it, but I manipulated it. And accuracy goes to, I would say that accuracy goes to quality. And we're not really assessing the quality of these things. So bottom line is if NIST 863-4 is staying centralized, staying as a Bible for government organizations to create digital identity that citizens could use, then why is Department of State still allowing us and not listening to NIST, the biometrics folks at NIST, and making them comply to 29794-5? And why are we still allowed to take our own photos and manipulate them and allowing that to be a foundational document? Similar for driver's license, but they at least those are taken live.
So we can't. So let me put it this way: we write guidance and we write standards. Implementation of those is not unfortunately our responsibility, right? That is the responsibility of agencies and organizations. And particularly when you start getting into the sphere of things like, passport policy and driver's license policy, those begin to start getting into real rulemaking organizations like DHS and State Department that have the responsibility to do those things. So we can provide guidance. We can provide recommendations. What agencies do with that is beyond our scope of responsibility. So again, we continue to provide the best recommendations that we can. Obviously our biometrics team is deeply involved with a lot of the testing and evaluation of biometric algorithms. But at the end of the day, there's not much that we can do with what State Department decides to do with their passport policy.
Very fair. And I see in -4, there's a lot on demographic differentials and the risk of getting it right, as was said in the introduction about equity. But I think unless they really understand the risk associated with this in your risk management, that where we talk about the risk of using a passport photo, is it really known that that is risky?
It's almost like you joined our risk management webinar just before this, this conversation. I mean, you're preaching to the choir, right? And I think that's why it's important for us to work together to figure out the right language on 63. And look, I know we're scoping the conversation to 63, but it sounds like in general, there's a lot of common research and research questions that we have where we could be partnering. So I won't volunteer Ryan's time or the rest of the identity team, but I don't think that's off the table if that's something that is helpful and gets us to a point where we're seeing emerging models like VCs reflected in guidance like this.
Yeah. And speaking as a CCG co-chair, like we do have the ability to, publish, effectively little notes from like, here's community's assessment and working back and forth with so and so. We'd be happy to go through and like work on some of that terminology side and like, how do we handle like the three party side? Because that feels like such a critical thing that is not, it may be possible, but it's not clear in the docs. And that's such a fundamental piece. Manu, quick question. I know you're up next on the queue, but I felt like since there was a call out to like DHS and the folks setting the policy and seeing someone from DHS on the line, would you mind if I called on them to ask some questions there? So Anil, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Oh, thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good night. Anil John, Technical Director, Department of Homeland Security. Hello, Dave Temeshek. Good to see you again as well. So it was interesting to hear, obviously very familiar with NIST, particularly in my former role as FICAM Technical Lead at GSA. And in this particular context, as it regards to verifiable credentials and decentralized identifiers, I am speaking obviously for the needs of a couple of my components of DHS, in particular U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services and U.S. Customs and Border Protection that are actively moving out on implementing verifiable credentials and decentralized identifiers in our operational use right now within the context of USCIS. It is about digitizing currently paper-based credentials that are focused on immigration, the permanent resident card, employment authorization documents, and the like. And obviously on the U.S. customs side, digitizing cross-border trade documents using the same technologies. So there are agencies within the U.S. federal government to whom this technology is obviously highly relevant, to whom 800-63 absolutely matters a lot. And separately, as somebody who was involved in helping what became 800-63-3, where we actually broke out the monolithic aspect of authenticators and identity proofing entirely separately, I think there is a path forward in order to sort of bake in what is needed with the decentralized identify ecosystem into 800-63 as well. So I am not going to put my NIST colleagues on the spot here, and that is not my intention, but I do think that there is a conversation that we need to have regarding to use a phrase earlier, I represent the interests of a particular organization that is in the benefits granting business on a population scale, on a global scale, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, that is using this technology and plans to use this technology. So we do need to find a way to make sure that the approaches of this technology are indeed something that is reflected in the structure of 800-63 so that we can all, salute and move forward and actually do right from the security and privacy. So the long and the short of it, guys, is that I think we are at a stage where we need to have a conversation, and I'll be reaching out to you.
Absolutely. Look forward to it. Also, that's one of the reasons we're here right now is we see that this is kind of, we want to make sure that the guidance is not 5 years behind the day it comes out. And so I think making sure that we are taking into account what's emerging, what's evolving, and being as clear as possible about how to fit different and new emerging models within the context of 63, I think is important going forward.
So I also want to be very clear, right? I think, you know, there is a framing that often goes on in this context, particularly in a lot of the government circles where this is emerging. This is very early. This is whatever. As the, you know, agency that actually originally funded some of the work around this 7 to 8 years ago, we've been involved in it from that beginning. So we don't consider this to be emerging, but we do consider this to be a long, painful process in order to ensure that there is global acceptance for these standards in all the things that we're doing. And particularly from the USCIS and CBP side, we are also looking at counterparties, you know, in both of those contexts that are, you know, moving out on the digital wallet use cases with the European Union's European Identity Digital Wallet. We are envisioning use cases where a, you know, EU member state citizen with that digital wallet has to come to the front door of a USCIS. And we would like to be in a position where our credentials can be issued into them and their attestations about things that are coming in, verifiable credentials, formats, and the like can be acceptable for us. So there is a desire to make sure that this is not just fit for purpose for government, but also on the global, you know, global interoperability side of, you know, jurisdictions and sovereigns talking to each other as well.
Yeah, and apologize for the use of emerging, but I think we share the same vision there, particularly in the ability to establish broad interoperability, global interoperability, and making sure that we're staying aligned and connected both internally as well as internationally.
Awesome. Cool. Looking forward to many continued interesting improvements to this spec. Manu, I see you on the queue and you might be the last one up depending on how long the answers are to your questions.
So. Sure. thanks, Mike. I guess this is in a similar vein. There are a number of technologies that the verifiable credentials and decentralized identifiers groups are, I don't want to say they're incubating. I don't want to say they're emerging, but, you know, these are privacy preserving technologies, right? And we've been trying for a very long time to try and push this work forward. So I noticed that, you know, 863C mentions, you know, privacy enhancing techniques. And I know that it's mentioned several times throughout the document. I think it would be helpful to call some of these technologies out more directly. Things like selective disclosure, things like unlinkable digital signatures, basically help individuals only expose the information that they need, right? I mean, there are things like general data protection regulation in the EU, and I know in the US there are different privacy regimes that are being talked about. And one of the challenges that we've had as a group is every time we start talking about selective disclosure or unlinkable signatures or things like that, almost immediately, you know, it's like NIST doesn't, that's not approved NIST crypto. It's not even talked about at NIST. Good luck. It's going to take another 10 years to get there, which, you know, kind of, it feels self-defeating. I'm wondering if, there has been, I'm sure there's been discussion about adding, you know, potential, beneficial future directions into these documents, without necessarily blessing them as, you know, appropriate at this point in time. Like, you know, there's, given the how long it takes these documents to kind of rev, it would be nice to have language in each of these documents that show that, you know, doing something like a pairing friendly curve, you know, BBS signature on something is of interest from a privacy perspective. Doing a selective disclosure, using, you know, SDJOT or some other mechanism, is something that is viewed as a viable, a reasonable goal to move towards. So that, you know, effectively we stop having these NIST specs being used as kind of hammers to stop that work, right? Because again, I think, as you said, And as is stated in the document, we're all trying to do the right thing and minimize information that's being shared and make sure that people's privacy are being protected. But one of the ways that some of the NIST publications are being used are to, you know, halt or slow some of that work. Certainly not by NIST, by, you know, other entities in the ecosystem. Have you considered or does this kind of language already exist, specifically language that calls out selective disclosure and why it's beneficial to use that in detail, or unlinkable signatures like BBS, and why it would be a useful attribute of a system to have that?
Yeah, we're certainly not trying to put a stop or slow down that work at all. I mean, I am based out of the cryptographic technology group at NIST, the one that puts out the cryptographic algorithm standards and guidelines. I mean, we've been very interested in, you know, a variety of approaches for privacy enhancing cryptography and privacy enhancing technologies. You know, so when NIST is engaged in places like ISO on the, you know, MDL standard, those are things, you know, features that we're looking for. I think it would be good to get your feedback, you know, it's good to get feedback here, but also good to get your feedback during the comment period on, you know, what could be some of those, you know, those properties that could be, you know, referenced. You know, we do talk about related properties in the context of, say, federation protocols, you know, but they don't, it doesn't necessarily have a, we don't really have a separate place that talks about those things in the context of things closer to verifiable credentials. So I think there's interesting work to go on. And I think that's also interesting work for, you know, basically, I think that's interesting feedback, both, you know, also for the, you know, NIST cryptographic technology group as we, you know, look at where we're, you know, looking to, you know, target our, you know, efforts. I mean, we have a lot of discussions about some of these things. I mean, we've had an active program on privacy enhancing cryptography for, you know, close to, you know, 10 years now, longer if depending on what you count. You know, I will acknowledge it. Part of the challenge that we have right now is that we're very interested in post-quantum cryptography and some of the techniques that have been historically pointed to, like pairings, you know, would be vulnerable. So, you know, we are also now looking at, you know, what new lattice-based schemes, you know, could be, you know, are out there in order to provide similar properties that would, you know, resist attacks by quantum computers. Anyways, I think you brought up a lot of very interesting points. I mean, I think those are things that we'll have to, you know, to dig into more.
And I think some of this might also have some opportunity to be a bit more precise and translatable in some of the language. I mean, we've got data minimization is a very important concept to us, and selective disclosure is a way to achieve that more directly. We've got concepts like, I think we call it derived attribute values, but essentially not providing all of the attributes so much as providing just kind of, you know, critical responses. But I think in particular, it'd be very valuable to get the very specific feedback. And the other thing I will add is we do work pretty closely with our privacy engineering team as well, too, who works on privacy enhancing technology, not just crypto based stuff, but, you know, other AI machine learning and kind of privacy enhancing models. So I do think if there are areas where you can point out very specific, hey, you know, you talk about this concept that's kind of sort of like the concept that we have over here, being more concise and being more specific about how this would look and what it might look like would be helpful to us as we start to, again, I think, account for the broader range of digital identity and credential models that are starting to emerge, well, or exist.
Yeah. And I think that's a great note to get, you know, kind of close on, as far as like, hey, a lot of this is terminology. Some of it is there is a gap, right? The role concept, like this three-party role section is not really covered, or explicitly allowed. And I mean, there's good call outs into OIDC and things like that in the draft, but not really back into like, well, how does this map in on the VC side? That's an area I think we can help. But that notion of derived, you know, I think I called out the exact section. I just mentioned it, right? That derived attribute values, right? That's a one-to-one effectively with this notion of a derived predicate, right? In the VC data model. And there are a number of items like that that I'm sure as folks are going through and prepping responses, hopefully they will call out because those are the things that are very actionable. And then just a big plus one on the, post-quantum stuff. So, just as always, like working on some of those things over at IETF, fine. Glad to know that that is on your mind as well as the machine learning side. So with that, I know we're about a minute and 40 seconds or so over time. I'm going to give NIST the big thanks. Really appreciate the time today from everyone. If there's any kind of final last words, thoughts, call to action, et cetera, let's please do it now. And then I'll stop the recording. And hopefully this is the first of many helpful, you know, productive back.
Yeah, and we are more than happy to continue to have these conversations. I think it's really important. And if you would like us to connect on how we can present to some of your other working groups to make sure they understand the intent of 63 and how it fits, just let us know and we'll figure out how to get some folks there.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure I know Christina is one of the editors for the VC working group. She's on this call. Manu, myself, edited a number of items along with some other folks on here. So I am sure there will be some reach outs. Drummond, I know, is on the queue and I think he's over at the, with more of the DID side. So I am sure there will be some reach outs for very specific working group and terminology and like, how does this apply? Can we clarify, type items? So awesome. Well, thank you so much all again. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate the great questions in from a number of folks. Just looking forward to practical, actionable stuff and, loving the fact that hopefully we can get some great comments back in and make this talk better for all of us. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.